Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Thousands of people are at Boston State House today as legislators in the House and Senate vote on a constitutional amendment that would define marriage as being only between a man and a woman. Supporters and opponents lined up early this morning.
My name is Maggie Pelkey. I'm from Newton, Massachusetts, and I'm here because I support traditional marriage between a man and a woman. I'm hoping to show support to the legislators so that they have courage to vote to not change the Constitution as it is already written, to show them that four judges who are unelected officials in our society made this decision without passing it through the legislature, without giving a vote to the people. This is an issue that people should definitely be able to vote on.
Ken Adams from Norton, Massachusetts. I'm hoping to see the amendment pass. I want the amendment. I want the definition to be very clear. One man, one woman.
My name is Vera O'Brien. I live in Plymouth, and I'm here because my husband Joe and I have been married 28 years, and we want other people to have the same opportunities and protections and privileges that we have been fortunate to have as a married couple. And we don't want our Constitution to discriminate against citizens in the Commonwealth.
Well, today's Constitutional Convention is the first step in a long process towards an amendment, which, if passed, would trump last week's Supreme Judicial Court ruling declaring that only same-sex marriage and not civil unions provide equality under Massachusetts law. Well, Senate President Robert Travolini is among those fighting to have the question of marriage moved from the courts to the voters, who would ultimately vote on changing the Constitution.
This approach restores these important social policy decisions back to the legislature and allows an opportunity for the voters of the Commonwealth to render an opinion.
But House Leader Tom Finneran says a constitutional amendment would be highly inappropriate. And as it stands now, this May, Massachusetts will be the first state in the union to allow same-sex couples the right to marry. WBUR's Audie Cornish is at the State House. And Audie, briefly to how this would work, if the Constitutional Convention today approves an amendment, it won't go into effect immediately. It has to be voted on again by legislators and then put before the electorate, correct?
Yes, that's correct. Basically, an amendment proposal like this one, which is the aim is to get it before voters on a ballot, has to get positive votes, more than the majority, in two successive legislative sessions. So they'll do one this year, and then next year they will have another, and will also have to be passed in whatever form it is passed the first time. So it takes two votes, then it goes to the ballot.
And in fact, would that, if indeed that amendment was passed in, 2006, would that make null the marriages that are scheduled to take place this May?
Well, that is a legal question that's still up in the air.
Right.
And also, there are two separate amendment proposals being floated around, one of which tries to address that very issue by that has a provision in it that would retroactively change all the marriages that take place this May, between May and 2006, lapse them into civil unions. So we've got one amendment that does try and deal with it. We don't know if that's legal or if it would survive legal challenge. We've got another amendment idea floating around where it doesn't deal with it at all. So it really is hard to know.
Yeah, let's talk about the amendments. The one that's being debated today, we understand, is the one that would define marriage as a union between men and women, but as you said, open the door to Vermont-style civil unions. And that's made for some very strange, if you will, bedfellows on this issue.
Well, right. There's one amendment that is on the agenda for today, and that one says marriage is for a man and a woman and no other institution or union is its legal equivalent. Now, people are trying to swap that amendment off the agenda and put in it this second amendment proposal, which has now been floated around, which seeks to have it both ways. This one specifically limits marriage as a heterosexual union, and at the same time specifically creates civil unions as an institution.
And how are people reacting to that, the idea of instituting the idea of civil unions again?
Well, most people don't want that sort of statutory concept put into the Constitution, and that's what this is all about. What do people want to see in the Constitution at the end of the day? Some people are afraid of amendments that don't say anything about rights and preserving rights or anything that seems too limiting, which puts the first proposal up in the air.
Yeah.
Other people say the second one goes way too far and tries to do too much, and we don't know if it'll work. It's not worth it. So for a compromise amendment, it's not really doing too well.
Right. Well, this has national political ramifications, of course. President Bush is said to back a federal constitutional amendment banning same-sex marriage. Leading Democratic presidential contender John Kerry is against gay marriage but for civil unions. And rising star Republican governor here in Massachusetts, Mitt Romney, just held a press conference. What did he say?
Well, he basically said that he was against the proposal that would try and implement civil unions specifically. And we did ask him, but he said that he was not hearing from the National Republican Party on this, that this is, you know, what he believed, that marriage is for one man and one woman, and that civil unions, meanwhile, are a legal legislative statute that should be dealt with separately.
Well, as we've said, legislators in Boston are clearly divided on this issue, and we should say again that many are against an amendment if it would introduce the idea of civil unions. It's not necessarily that they're for gay marriage. So,
and not necessarily that they're against civil unions. They just don't want to see it in the Constitution.
Right. There's that as well. So any idea what may happen this afternoon?
Absolutely none. Moreover, because the item is number 8 on a legislative list of 10 different controversial amendment proposal items, they may take a special vote to move the marriage amendment further up in the day. But the fact is this could be a several days long process in of itself just to hold the convention.
Well, Audie, thank you very much. WBUR's Audie Cornish reporting from the Massachusetts State House. For continuing coverage of this story, go to our website, here-now.org.
John Kerry continues to catapult toward the Democratic nomination for president. Now, many primaries remain, and in politics, as in life, it ain't over till it's over. But Boston Brahmin Kerry did win in the southern states of Virginia and Tennessee yesterday, leading at least one of his Democratic opponents to decide that it is over. Southerner Wesley Clark will end his presidential campaign this afternoon. Kerry last night thanked his supporters, and as he often does, he called special attention to fellow veterans of the Vietnam War.
Once again, I express my special thanks to the remarkable brigade of veterans who have crossed this country, Senator Max Cleland, the same band of brothers that I depended on 30 years ago, and I've said it before and I will say it again. We may be a little bit older, we may be a little bit grayer, but we still know how to fight for our country.
Well, this, as President Bush faced continuing questions about his military service during Vietnam. In a contentious press conference, White House press spokesman Scott McClellan yesterday offered newly discovered documents, pay records, which he said should end doubts about whether Bush fulfilled his obligations in the Texas Air National Guard. But some say questions remain. Walter Robinson is an investigative reporter for the Boston Globe who's been looking into Bush's military record since it became an issue in the 2000 presidential campaign. Welcome, Walter.
Hi, Bill. How are you?
Good, thanks. Thanks for joining us. Walter, the White House produced records showing now President Bush was paid for Air National Guard duty between mid-1972 and mid-1973. That's the year he's accused of being AWOL, absent without leave. Case closed?
No. First of all, I mean, we have not accused him of being AWOL. We have only pointed to the fact that during that year up until yesterday, there had been no records that he did any duty.
Right. Others have accused him of that, not
That's
the
right.
Boston Globe.
The records that were produced yesterday show attendance for 25 days of duty during that year. The White House said that means he fulfilled his duty. Actually, the requirement for a guardsman back then was 39 days of duty, so he didn't. He came in short. So the White House says this ends the issue. The problem is he's now recorded as having attended duty on dates when his superiors are on record as saying they never saw him.
And no other fellow members of the Air National Guard have ever emerged, let alone the officers, to say, oh, yeah, I remember George Bush showing up that day, or we hung out for that weekend, right?
Yeah, that's right. Now, in fairness, we're talking about something 30 years ago. But it is interesting that since 2000, Democrats in Alabama have been offering a reward for anyone who will come forward and say they saw Bush do duty either in Alabama or in Texas, and there hasn't been anyone.
You know, the White House also produced a retired Lieutenant Colonel Albert C. Lloyd Jr. yesterday, a Texas Air National Guard personnel specialist. Now, yesterday the White House said that the documents proved that Bush had a satisfactory year for retirement / retention. But that then evolved in an interview with the retired Lieutenant Colonel last night, right?
Right. I mean, we established pretty clearly yesterday that there are two minimal standards. The one the White House seized on was that if he were a 30-year man and were going to retire, he had enough points for that 1 year for retirement purposes. But for actual training requirements, i.e. showing up for weekend drills and annual active duty, he didn't make it.
And you spoke to the Lieutenant Colonel yourself last night, right?
We've been talking to Lloyd since the year 2000. And
he kind of backed away from what he'd said then.
Well, you know, he believes that technically Bush fulfilled his requirements, but he acknowledges that, in fact, in terms of what he was required to do for training, he didn't.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Walter, the White House based its contention that President Bush fulfilled his duty back then on records of being paid, but National Guard members certainly could have been paid back then, even though they didn't show up, right?
There are a fairly large number of documented cases of that. There's no evidence in this case that that's what happened, but it is possible. So the White House, Mr. McClellan, the spokesman, was pretty careful to say that these records show that then-Lieutenant Bush was paid on these dates, he would not make a claim that Bush had actually shown up on the particular date listed for the payment. So the inquiries continue.
Walter, just to finish up, as an investigative reporter, in some ways the investigative reporter covering this story for years now, what's still most confusing to you? What's still most missing?
Well, I mean, there are a lot of issues. What is most intriguing is this period when he was in Alabama, supposedly from May of 72 until sometime near the end of 72. You know, a lot of reporters are curious about that, and I think the records, to the White House's surprise, that came out yesterday, I think sort of raised more questions in people's minds than they did settle questions.
Walter Robinson is an investigative reporter with the Boston Globe. Thanks, Walter.
Okay, thank you, Bill.
Just ahead, trouble with the Hubble. Time is running out for the supersized telescope.
And later in the show, we'll find out what exactly a bistro is.
There's more coming up here and now. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Since its launch in 1990, the Hubble Space Telescope has peered more deeply into space, and so more deeply back into time and the origins of the universe, than any eye before it, its vision unblemished by Earth's atmosphere. But now the Hubble needs a repair job, and NASA's decided it will not send a shuttle aloft to fix it. Instead, the Hubble will be scrapped, allowed to go blind, brought back to Earth by a special robotic rocket. Tomorrow, the House Science Committee is reviewing a decision devotees of the Hubble have expressed outrage about. Michael Benson joins us. He's author of Beyond, Visions of the Interplanetary Probes. He joins us from his home in Ljubljana, Slovenia. Welcome, Michael.
Thanks very much for having me.
Michael, as briefly as you can, how important is the Hubble to science?
Oh, I think the Hubble is, I think it's widely viewed as being the most important scientific and technological achievement of modern times. It's very comparable in its impact to Galileo's first use of the telescope.
So, Michael, what's NASA's argument for scrapping the Hubble? It seems to have something to do with safety.
Yeah, NASA has gotten itself into kind of a strange position. It announced that it would not visit the Hubble to service it less than a week after the Bush administration announced a new initiative to take human beings back to the moon and then on to Mars. It didn't want it to seem that its decision to not service the Hubble had primarily to do with financial questions. So it said that it's not safe to go there, and it used as its justification the Columbia Accident Investigation Board report.
Well, two things, of course, come to mind right away. 1993, a space shuttle triumphantly did go up and fix the Hubble at that time. And also, space shuttle missions are to continue to the International Space Station until, I believe, it's 2014. So what's the problem with going to the Hubble telescope?
Yeah, I mean, this story has gotten more and more fascinating because after NASA announced, you know, that it really wasn't safe to do it, a few days ago, it became clear that a report was in circulation among astronomers and in Congress and now in the media. It's unsigned, but it's written by clearly some dissident NASA engineers who really thought the decision should not have been made on the basis of safety. And this report, which I read today, basically demolishes entirely NASA, the management of NASA's argument that it's not safe to go to Hubble. It points out that in many ways it's more dangerous to go to the International Space Station because the International Space Station is in a kind of a strange orbit, which requires a longer engine burn to get there.
Now, I do understand that concern over this decision to scrap Hubble has led NASA Administrator Sean O'Keefe to rethink his decision. He's appointed Admiral Hal Gaiman, chairman of the Columbia Accident Investigation Board, to review the cancellation. What's the latest on that?
Well, it's interesting. He actually didn't say that he's reviewing his decision. I think he's appeasing critics in Congress more than anything else. He has said that he's going to stick by his decision, but he wants the admiral to kind of review the situation. We'll see, though. Apparently on Thursday there will be a hearing in Congress about this issue, and I'm sure that these reports, which are in circulation from the anonymous NASA engineers, will come up in that meeting.
Yeah, that's at the House Science Committee. I should also point out that NASA's Associate Administrator for Spaceflight, Bill Reedy, has said this week that the Hubble will be scrapped. He said that's a fait accompli. Michael, we certainly can understand after the Columbia tragedy last year that NASA would be hypersensitive about anything that would be too risky for astronauts. And after all, the Hubble was supposed to come down in the next several years anyway. This would probably only cost the Hubble a few years' life taking pictures deep into space, right?
Well, it's not necessarily true that it was scheduled to come down in a few years anyway. When they launched the thing in 1990, they didn't necessarily think it would still be in operation in 2004. They didn't know. It can continue working, and it is still producing a lot of valuable science. In fact, it's a little bit strange for me to read in various news stories that the telescope is an aging observatory because, in fact, it's in perfectly good shape. It's just that it needs, you know, like a laptop, it needs new batteries occasionally because they don't, you know, they wear out after a while. Mm. But it's a very effective instrument, and it's got a huge number of astronomers. I think that it's a 6-to-1 ratio, the amount of requests to use the instrument versus the amount of time actually available on it.
Just to finish up, Michael, you've run some numbers on how much it would cost to fix it and how much it would cost to bring it down. What did you learn?
Yeah, this is another interesting part of the story. I mean, first of all, they've spent already $200 million on new instruments and batteries and gyroscopes for the mission, which they decided to cancel, for the Hubble. And because they've decided not to visit it, they have to figure out a way to bring it down safely because it's the size of a school bus. You can't let it just crash into the Earth anywhere. The current estimate for the cost of building a robot rocket which would go and rendezvous with the Hubble and bring it down is $300 million. Now, the cost of one shuttle mission to the Hubble is $500 million. So if you put together the $300 million, which could easily get, you know, increased because they haven't built this thing before, a robot that can rendezvous with the Hubble, when you put that together with the science instruments, which they're going to have to end up throwing out or leaving on a shelf somewhere, you end up with the same figure. So that's kind of the ridiculousness of the situation. For the same amount of money it would take to go service the Hubble and have it observing for another decade or so, you can bring it down into the Pacific Ocean. So it seems to me that the choice is pretty clear.
How much chance do you think there is that NASA will reverse its decision? I should also point out that the Hubble telescope, outside the costs of fixing it or bringing it down, is pretty cost effective, only about 2% of NASA's budget. How much chance do you think there is that the Hubble will stay in the sky and be fixed?
Well, that is really the $500 million question. I mean, we'll find out more on Thursday about the extent to which Congress, the House Science Committee, will put pressure on NASA to reverse the decision. I think that it's a PR disaster for NASA to bring the thing down. I mean, it has been such an effective tool in popularizing science, apart from, well, very connected to its scientific achievements.
Michael Benson joined us from Ljubljana, Slovenia. He's author of Beyond, Visions of the Interplanetary Probes. Michael Benson, thanks a lot.
Thanks a lot for having me.
Tomorrow on Here and Now, a military analyst says the United States is now in a state of perpetual war, and the armed services can't keep up with it.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now. I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
A year before Janet Jackson's breast was exposed at the Super Bowl, rock star Bono uttered the F-word during the Golden Globe Awards. Last October, the FCC ruled that usage was not indecent because Bono used the word as an adjective, not a verb. Lawmakers objected, and the result, a hearing today on Capitol Hill, where FCC Chair Michael Powell called for higher fines, more self-policing on the part of the networks, and closer scrutiny of cable.
The time has come for the Commission, the Congress, and the industry, and the public, as Senator Graham said, to take the necessary steps to prevent allowing the worst of television and all that it has to offer from reaching unsuspecting children.
Well, joining us on the line is Mark Jerkowitz. He's the media critic at the Boston Globe. And Mark, some are saying this is new language for Michael Powell. Why the talk of decency standards now? Just because of Bono and Janet?
You put those two things together in an election year, and suddenly you have the FCC talking tough, the FCC chairman talking tough, bills to increase fines against indecency. So you can see sort of the galvanization of a political issue here.
It seems also that there might be a couple of issues colliding here. One of the FCC commissioners this morning said that increasing media conglomeration opens the door to more filth reaching children. That's a quote.
Yep.
He explicitly referred to Comcast's bid to take over Disney as an example. But this was an FCC that backed media ownership.
Well, that's interesting. And yes, and a lot of critics of Michael Powell and this FCC say, boy, they can't wait to jump all up and down over an exposed breast on television. But the bigger, more fundamental issue, the media conglomeration, the sucking up of more and more media outlets into fewer big hands, they've not only have they been complacent about it, they've actually been totally supportive and waved it through. And frankly, the pressure on broadcast TV comes from the kind of profanity, nudity, obscenity that they get on cable. So what that does say at the end of the day is if you really believe in market forces, as Michael Powell says he does, we're going to get some knuckles wrapped, you know, among the broadcasters and the networks here. But I don't think you're going to see any turning back of the clock away from the kind of raunchier language and imagery and things that we've been seeing on primetime TV, because that's really where the market forces are going.
Well, in fact, FCC Chair Powell did send a letter to the Cable Association sort of indicating that they might be tougher on cable, but it's a paid subscription service. 85% of viewers now get their information through cable, but is there any chance that the FCC could ever regulate a paid service?
It's one thing to talk about making sure that Everybody Loves Raymond doesn't include harsh curse words. That I think, might be a realistic goal. Mm. To suggest that Tony Soprano is going to start saying fudge and fiddlesticks, I think that's a bit much.
Well, the Wall Street Journal points out today that many large broadcast companies really can't complain that they have to compete with these popular sex and violent programs on cable when they increasingly own the cable as well, which gets us back to media cross-ownership.
Well, you know, that's a pretty good argument. But having said that, what cable has done, the social climate created by the more risque cable shows, the Sex and the City, the Sopranos, also creates the cultural climate in which there's some expectation that broadcast television, even primetime television, is going to reflect what's really out there. I think that's the fundamental issue there.
Well, media ownership is being considered in the Philadelphia courts today. We remember last June the FCC passed these new ownership rules backing more ownership of media outlets by one company. Consumer groups sued. They won in a Philly court. It's being appealed today. How is this current climate, in other words, the discussion of indecency, going to affect that issue, media ownership?
What is interesting about what's going on in Philadelphia is that I think the FCC, and Michael Powell in particular, was taken aback by the kind of grassroots opposition that emerged, both liberal and conservative, to the easing of the ownership regulations that were passed in June by the FCC. The main similarity here is you start to see them having the same kind of constellation of forces now complaining about the quality and the content of programming as well.
Mm-hmm.
But the truth of the matter is market forces usually win out in this situation. So I think don't expect to turn on your TV a year from now and see a sanitized broadcast TV program environment. Not going to happen.
Mark Jerkowitz, thank you.
You're welcome.
Mark Jerkowitz is media critic for the Boston Globe.
As immense as President Bush's new $2.4 trillion budget is, it does call for eliminating 65 federal programs and cutting 63. The savings? About $5 billion. Sound like a lot? Well, it's a savings of less than 0.25% of the entire budget. To discuss which programs are targeted, we're joined by Robert Bixby, Executive Director of the Concord Coalition. Welcome, Bob.
Hi, Bill. How are you?
I'm good, and thanks for joining us. Bob, we can't go through all 128 federal programs to be cut or eliminated in the Bush budget, but in general terms, what kind of programs is the president calling to cut or terminate?
A lot of them are small federal grant programs. They're heavily clustered in education and the Justice Department. In fact, about two-thirds of the cost savings from these programs come from those two departments.
Now, a short laundry list: Rural Utilities Service Electric Loan Program, Agricultural Research Service, Gifted and Talented Education Program, the National Writing Project, Migrant and Seasonal Farm Workers Projects. Now, is there any way to calculate in human terms who gets hurt by this and whether, in fact, some of these programs are kind of maybe cuttable?
Well, no doubt they are. Some of them are cuttable. What's missing from the budget is any sort of specific analysis of why these programs were the ones that were cut, although there are little summaries in some of the items that just say that this program is no longer necessary, or this program is duplicative of some other federal program. And that may well be, but there's no real way of knowing why these programs were selected and others were not.
Now, is this fairly typical for any president's budget that 128 programs would be cut or eliminated? Is that a fairly standard thing?
No, I think that every now and then a president, when there's a focus on the deficit, will go into these programs and propose to make eliminations. A lot of times Congress doesn't go along with it. But I think the important thing about this is the president has been under the gun from a lot of conservatives about spending too much. And so the effort in this budget is to show that he's cutting back. And one way you can do that is by saying that you're eliminating a lot of programs.
And yet it's such a minuscule amount of money compared to the entire budget.
Well, it is, compared to the size of the deficit. The $5 billion savings, assuming that all of this took place, would be measured against a projected deficit of $360 billion for next year. It's more of a public relations thing, I think, than anything else, because, as I say, the savings, even if you achieve them, are not going to come anywhere near closing the gap. An interesting statistic, in the 10 agencies and departments that are targeted here, if you eliminated all funding, not just these programs, but if you eliminated all funding for these 10 agencies and departments, it would come out to $239 billion, still well short of what it would take to balance the budget. So, we're just sort of trimming the edges here. It's not really deep savings.
Robert Bixby is executive director of the Concord Coalition. Bob, thanks a lot.
Okay, thank you.
Still to come, is a bistro just a fancy name for a great restaurant? We'll find out when we visit one.
You're listening to Here and Now.
In order to gain asylum in the United States, a person must prove that they would be persecuted if sent back to their home country because of race, religion, nationality, membership in a social group, or political beliefs. Now, a woman from Guatemala is saying she should be granted asylum because of her gender, arguing that is a social group. And U.S. Attorney General John Ashcroft has said he will decide the case himself. Joining us on the line is Professor Karen Musalo. She's of the UC Hastings College of the Law in California, and she's also representing Rody Alvarado, the Guatemalan woman seeking asylum. And Karen, what is Rody Alvarado saying?
Rody Alvarado was in a situation where her husband brutalized her throughout the entire course of a 10-year marriage with beatings, dragging her by the hair, breaking windows and mirrors with her head, really horrific mistreatment. And she went to both the police and the courts in her country and was rebuffed at every turn. Their opinion was this was a matter that was not of interest to them. This was a matter in the home. And she felt the only way to save her life was to flee Guatemala and to seek protection in the United States.
As you well know, opponents of Rody Alvarado's claim have said that as tough as spousal abuse may be, it's not up to the United States to improve the marriages of people worldwide. And it sort of interferes with social policy, as horrific as it is to us, if it's accepted in a home country, whether it's honor killings or spousal abuse. And also, it would mean less room for asylum seekers suffering political torture, for instance.
First of all, this kind of abuse is a violation of fundamental human rights, and the purpose of our refugee laws are to protect people from violations of their human rights. And when you talk about honor killings or domestic violence where a woman is basically tortured, this is a severe enough type of harm that under international and under U.S. law has been recognized to be an appropriate basis. Mm-hmm. The key point in this is that the government of Guatemala refused to protect her. And we recognize that when the government either directly persecutes or the government allows private individuals to persecute, that is appropriately a matter for protection.
Karen, do you worry that if John Ashcroft rules in your client's favor, that it will open the floodgates to millions of women around the world who suffer just horrific abuse?
Canada has been accepting these types of cases since 1993, and if you look at their statistics, they've experienced no floodgates. The number of gender claims that have actually come to Canada are minuscule, less than several hundred a year. And I represented Fozia Kasinga, a woman seeking asylum from the practice of female genital cutting in Togo. And that case was back in 1996, and people raised the same arguments against granting her protection, saying that if she were given asylum, then the millions of women in various countries that undergo female genital cutting would all arrive on the doors of the U.S., knocking on the door asking for protection. Fozia Kasinga was granted protection in a landmark decision, and the floodgates never materialized in that case. And I really strongly doubt that they would materialize in this case. The reality is that women who are in these situations simply don't have the resources or the abilities, whatever it takes, to leave everything near and dear behind.
Karen, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Karen Musala is director of the Center for Gender and Refugee Studies at the UC Hastings College of the Law in California, representing the case of Rody Alvarado.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now. I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
With Valentine's Day approaching, we're reminded to get reservations in early at favorite restaurants or bistros, which reminds us as well, we've always wondered, what exactly is a bistro? The word evokes Paris and romance and something more. We decided to visit Boston's award-winning Hammersley's Bistro, one of the first in this country. Owner and chef Gordon Hammersley has just published a new book, Bistro Cooking at Home. He greeted us at the door in his ever-present Boston Red Sox baseball cap and his chef's whites.
Bistro cooking is the cooking of casual neighborhood restaurants in France. Big, hearty soups, great, wonderful peasant bread, slow-braised dishes, nicely roasted chickens, all of the kinds of thing that you think of as classical French food is actually usually bistro food.
But it sounds like that it's also heavier and fare, maybe?
Hard to say. I mean, you know, bistros vary a lot, actually, these days. There are classic bistros which tend to be a little bit on the heavier side. That is true. Lots of cream, lots of butter, lots of cheese, that kind of thing. But on the other hand, there are contemporary bistros in France now that are serving very light, very cool, very interesting kinds of foods. It's more about ambiance than about anything else.
I think that's what I meant. Sort of not nose in the air, you know.
Absolutely right. You know, it's there's no attitude in these restaurants. You know, we like to think of ourselves as a friendly, comforting, wonderful neighborhood restaurant.
Well, let's go take a look, if you could walk us through. How do you, I mean, it's a beautiful restaurant. We should say we're in the entranceway. There's a bar to the left. Right. And so we go into the main room.
The room is long and narrow. It's got kind of buttery yellow walls, which we think is kind of reminiscent of a French farmhouse and also a wonderful French bistro. Around the corner here, we have our kitchen, and this is a 25-foot open kitchen, open to the public. So, you know, as soon as you put a 25-foot commercial kitchen into the middle of a dining room, it's awfully hard to be too darn elegant. So,
let's go into the kitchen, can we?
Okay. Yep.
You know, I'm wondering, you mentioned roast chickens and braised dishes. What is the difference between, let's say, my grandma's, well, not mine, but, you know, someone's grandmother's roast chicken and something that people are, you know, frankly paying for here at the restaurant or cooking from the book?
I think it's a good question, and I'm not sure of the answer. Maybe your mother's roast chicken is just as good as mine. We're inflicting flavor on foods in ways that maybe your grandmother isn't. Our particular roast chicken is marinated with garlic and lemon and parsley and mustard and olive oil and rosemary for 4 or 5 hours. And then it goes into a relatively slow oven. And then it gets doused with a little bit of double chicken stock. And it gets put underneath our broiler so that the skin gets really, really crispy. I mean,
yeah, no, it's different.
a little bit different. I guess, you know, to me, the bistro cooking is like the ultimate home cooking, cuisine bourgeoise, if you will, brought to a restaurant level.
Should we lumber through here? I don't want to get in anyone's way.
No, absolutely. They'll pay attention to us as we go through.
It's a huge oven, of course, with about 20 burners going, great guns. Huge flames, big flames under. What is that dish there?
This is a lamb stew, and so it's just coming to a boil. It was braised this afternoon, and now we're just kind of reheating it now.
I think producer Emiko Tamagawa is going to be served for dinner in a moment. If we're not careful, we're just, okay.
So we're in the salad section of the restaurant now, kind of salad slash appetizer. Dan's making a green salad here. You can see that crispy piece of goat cheese, which is on the top.
I loved reading in your book that, you know, you're thinking, well, salads, well, how can a salad be a bistro salad? Well, if you put a fried egg on top.
Exactly. I mean, you know, that's what's so great about bistro food is that, you know, it's not just simple, elegant greens, but it's simple, elegant greens, and then you put artichokes on it or a poached egg or, in this case, crispy goat cheese.
How to say this? This is not the delicate, fine French cooking. It's fine French cooking, but it's not what people think of.
No, you're absolutely right. I mean, it's got incredible soul and spirit to it.
We can't take the heat, so we're going to get out of the kitchen.
Move right out of here.
Okay.
Let me leave.
You leave. We're back out in the dining room at Hammersley's Bistro in Boston with Gordon Hammersley, and I'm flipping, Gordon, through your cookbook, and I see, just even in the pictures I'm looking at, instead of dicing into tiny little squares your onions, you just put big chunks of them in.
Yeah, I mean, to me, that's what bistro cooking is all about as well. You know, when I started this restaurant, I swore to myself I would never cut another tiny vegetable, ever, because I'm not very good at it. And I used to work for a French guy, you know, who would come by my table as I was making the smallest dice of carrots I possibly could, and he would come and he would say, "Monsieur, this one is good, and this one is bad, and this one is bad, and this one is bad. What are you doing?" And he would throw the whole thing on the floor, and I'd have to start again. I went, "Oh, my God, I'm never doing this when I grow up."
Now you just stick the whole carrot in.
Exactly right.
This is one of the most romantic spots in this city, and bistros have become a very romantic place, and with Valentine's Day, I know you're always book solid.
Yes, it's an amazing day. We love to watch couples do what they do, and we have that catbird seat, remember, in the kitchen, watching what goes on. Something wacky always happens. Somebody proposes to somebody. We had one year where we were coerced into having waiters bring a banner through the dining room that was about 15 feet long and 5 feet high saying, "Vicky, will you marry me?" And thank God Vicky said yes. You know, it's those kinds of crazy things that happen. Or, you know, the year that some girl overturned her glass and plate and walked out on her boyfriend and he was left there kind of looking like a fool. Anything can happen on those nights.
Our visit to Hammersley's Bistro with chef-owner Gordon Hammersley was produced by Almost Entree Emiko Tamagawa. Gordon's new book is Bistro Cooking at Home.
Here and Now's roving poets, Jim Burley and Molly Sicardo, have their own thoughts on Valentine's Day.
So, Jim, it's almost Valentine's Day.
Yeah, my favorite day of the year.
Well, perennial bachelor that you are, I thought I would try and convince you that marriage is a wonderful thing.
Well, good luck.
All right. Two lives. We crashed into love, learning quickly to fly in tandem. Your laugh was my sun. My earth grew salty with your body. Your breath became my sky. We made time like love a party for two. At 10, 2 cups of coffee, 1 daydream to last till dinner. Then glass plates, mismatched knives, 2 spoons dipping into 1 pint of ice cream. A wedding formalized the blend of our lives. Now 2 boys and a generation later, do we sip gold champagne from slender flutes as the bright music of our love songs fade, or do we yet sway to the tunes from the poet's lute? Loves become truth and beauty combined to make bedrock. Like the sea and the sand form great oceans, like flour and sugar create cake. We've built, minute by minute, mountains from the dreams that we made.
Well, that is a lovely poem and very fitting for Valentine's Day. But I also have a poem.
Oh, I can't wait.
Yes. It's written in the style of The Passionate Shepherd to His Love by Christopher Marlowe.
One of my favorites.
I know it is. And here it goes. Come live with me to live in sin, or be my understanding girlfriend. Never, never marry me, or make me marry you. No, please. Why drag a priest into it? Or see how a tux is supposed to fit. Children are another terrible thing, and who can afford an engagement ring? And we will pleasures prove and all, as long as you never make me take you to the mall. And you don't have to make me mow the lawn or take out the garbage, which is always a yawn. So please live with me to live in sin until the bitter end. Never make me marry you, please. I have trouble with commitment, you see.
All right, well, that's definitely a point of view. There's a lot to be said for sin.
I like sin.
But, Jim,
yes.
Does that mean you won't marry me?
I don't think so. We'd have to ask your husband.
Here are now's roving poets, Jim Burley and Molly Sicardo.
Too late to talk Jim out of sending that as a Valentine. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
Get into your radio.
And join us again, Here and Now. For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.